proposal. And so we have scheduled time to do that today. And we'll start with Scott Lights.
There's two people that have to leave.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Scott Lights. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Health. I'm going to do a very, very brief introduction, and then I will turn it over to Dr. Ben Bockwig and Mary Chesney, and then I'll come back and be happy to go into a longer presentation for you, Madam Chair. Let me just say that payment reform is one of the cornerstones of the recommendations from the Transformation Task Force. The Transformation Task Force felt that in order for the system to be one that is sustainable over time, that gets the best efficiency, gets the highest quality care, that it was necessary and important and critical that the state do a better job of aligning incentives in the healthcare system in order to unleash the innovation of providers, in order to engage consumers more fully in healthcare, and in order to align the system in a better way that actually reinforces many of the cost-saving, high-quality-producing innovations that healthcare providers would like to be able to do, but that the current healthcare system prevents them from doing under the current payment system. So I will go into more detail on that a bit later, Madam Chair, but with that introduction to sort of the general scope of what the task force is recommended and is looking at, I would be happy to turn it over to some of the other testifiers at this time.
Thank you very much. Why don't both of you come up to the table? And whoever wants to go first, I understand you both have to leave to get back to your clinics, so.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Mary Chesney, and I'm an advanced practice nurse and have been an advanced practice nurse for 25 years. I currently am employed at the University of Minnesota, where I practice as a pediatric nurse practitioner, both at the International Adoption Clinic and also serve as clinical director for the specialty clinic in pediatrics at the U. I really want to thank you today for this opportunity to come before you as a passionate nurse advocate for healthcare reform. It's very striking to me that a number of the foundational concepts for the profession of nursing fits so well and are so relevant to our discussion of what's needed in healthcare reform today. Nurses practice holistic, patient-centered care. Nurses are often very capable in helping patients and assisting them in managing their health within the context of their environment. And nurses are expert in teaching patients about ways to take care of their health in health promotional and prevention activities. I really believe that if we're truly going to reform healthcare, however, we must move away from this tyranny of the visit, this reimbursement piece having to be tied to dragging someone into clinic, whether they need it or not. If we want to have a system that emphasizes things that keep people healthy, such as health promotion, patient education, health counseling, preventive services, care coordination, and effective chronic disease management, we are going to need to have nurses play a larger role in providing these types of cost-effective services. But sadly, under our current system, much of the valuable work performed by nurses receives little to no reimbursement. To accomplish the type of aggressive reform agenda that we'd like to accomplish and to contain costs, a strong argument was made this summer, both in the Healthcare Access Commission Task Force and the Governor's Task Force, on the need for a healthcare home model. Critical to this model, however, is the need for use of an interdisciplinary healthcare team. It's going to be important, therefore, that we have some kind of payment structure that invests in and reimburses and supports the work of every member of that team. Interdisciplinary healthcare team members may include any number of professionals such as registered nurses, physicians, advanced practice registered nurses, pharmacists, CMAs, and so on. There are a number of reasons to advocate for use of interdisciplinary teams with a healthcare home model. First, I think it's just going to take the work of a team to ease the primary care physician shortage that we know is coming And we know that that shortage is going to be exacerbated by the fact that we're moving towards universal health care, which is a great thing. But all of those folks are going to need primary health care services. It's important to note that the findings from a large body of literature, research literature, clearly substantiates that advanced practice registered nurses can perform 60 to 80% of primary health care needs, and they do it very well. Therefore, it's going to be essential to healthcare reform that advanced practice registered nurses be included as healthcare home providers. However, quite honestly, there are regulatory barriers that exist right now for advanced practice registered nurses, and I believe that some of these barriers are going to need to be removed in order to allow nurses to practice to the top of their capabilities and to the top of their scope of practice. The most important reason we should be focusing on interdisciplinary healthcare home teams is because that model is quite simply the best way to deliver really high quality, cost-effective care. An effective team uses each of its members to the best of their abilities. They use the strengths and talents of each of the providers, and they use the most cost-effective provider for the given circumstance. In other words, I think we can attain efficiencies and cost savings can be realized if we use the right person doing the right job in the right way at the right time and in the right given situation. Within a healthcare home practice, for example, a physician's time could be well spent in really focusing on the most complex patients. Minor and chronic illness management could very capably be delivered by a nurse practitioner or a physician assistant. One problem that I see in the current system, however, is that it requires patients to come in order for the clinic to receive a dime of reimbursement. However, that's not always the best way to manage a patient's healthcare. Many health or chronic disease concerns can often be managed best through the use of RN phone triage, patient education, or use of brief but frequent phone or email touch points or check-ins with the patient in order to monitor their condition and provide them with support to manage their chronic disease. For example, in our pediatric specialty clinic, we have a team of professionals who provide care for children with type 1 juvenile onset insulin-dependent diabetes. For families who have a newly diagnosed child trying to learn how to manage the rigors of this disease, how to manage blood sugars, how to dose insulin and adjust insulin dosage for blood sugars, and how to figure out all the dietary management issues, is really a struggle for these families. Bringing a child into clinic every week or so just doesn't cut it. It simply is not enough support for a family who is grieving a new diagnosis and is feeling completely overwhelmed. However, if you have a skilled diabetic nurse on the phone with that family once a day, checking in, finding out what blood sugars are, helping parents make decisions about insulin dosage, that type of service is like a lifeline to those families, and it results in much better outcomes for the children. However, our current system doesn't pay one dime for that type of important care. Care coordination for patients with chronic or complex health care conditions is essential to high-quality care. In past work at the university, I provided care for a number of medically fragile children. Many of these children saw anywhere from 3 to 6 or more specialists. Coordination of care activities included the need to review all the recommendations from those specialists, to provide documents for medication management, for treatment protocols at school, and to act as a resource for the school nurses managing these children day to day. Care services required that I refer and monitor rehabilitative services for many of the children, and there are hours consumed in completing health care forms for special transportation needs, TEFRA papers, and so on. My goal in coordinating care for these children, however, was to take the recommendations of all these specialists who were looking at one organ system for this child and to work with that and coordinate it as I was looking at this whole wonderful little person in front of me and trying to take care of the whole package. That time that was consumed was incredible, and sadly, none of the services that I was providing in those care coordination activities were reimbursed. And yet I felt compelled to do it because these families carry a heavy load and they needed help. And I knew that it ended up resulting in children having much better health care outcomes. And many a time it could keep a child out of a hospital or keep them at home or keep them in school, which is really important. I could give you countless examples of how costs could be saved and patient care could be improved if we weren't tied to this tyranny of the visit structure that currently exists in our payment system. We need to fix the care delivery model, and we need to have a payment system that promotes full use of every member of the healthcare team. It's time to fix the payment system so that it recognizes and reimburses the valuable work that's being performed by nurses. It's time to fix the payment system so that it rewards best models of care delivery that are truly suited to the people of Minnesota and helps them stay as healthy as possible. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions for Ms. Chesney. Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Chesney, for your testimony this morning. I'm a nurse myself, so thank you for the work you do with citizens and patients. My question is, we're big supporters here of payment reform and getting to exactly what you're talking about. But the way the situation is right now, if you're talking about providing RN services to, these children with fragile diabetes and so on, if you're not being paid, have you been just donating your time, or are they private pay situations? And then what happens if it's private pay and the families can't afford it?
As far as, for the diabetic nurse educators within our system, I think that the physicians that serve these children are so committed to the work that they do. But the upshot of it is that those physicians have to crank out that many more visits, get that many more kids in the door so that they can support the important work of the nurses, since the nurses do not get reimbursed for that type of care. In my situation, quite frankly, I don't know if you noticed, I used the term, I used to do this. I'm not currently providing this type of care coordination. And part of it, quite frankly, is I had decided to return to graduate school, and I could no longer donate my personal time. So much of the care coordination activity had to occur outside of my normal work day because I still had to see that number of patients that I had to get in the door in order to have my salary paid. So that required that the care coordination stuff was happening at, 5:30, 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock at night. And when I decided to return to school, I could no longer work and manage that type of a load. So I do think that there are committed providers out there trying their best right now to perform like a healthcare home model for families. But quite frankly, they're getting fried because there just isn't money to support it. And we're having to see a full complement of patients and deal with their needs in addition to this really important care coordination work.
And, Senator, I know in the case of the Youth Special Kids Project that the state has given them small grants. In addition to that, they go out and do a lot of private fundraising. Well, of course, that isn't going to work for the whole system, because they have a special project for kids. They can do this fundraising.
Follow-up question, Madam Chair. And I think you bring up a whole other topic, which knits together just like this with the need for payment reform, is the effect on nurses. So if you are actually delivering patient care in the terms of, care coordination, your example, outside your working day because it's the right thing to do, this is exactly what we're hearing from nurses across the state, burning out. I mean, nurses want to do the right thing, and they want to get their patient the care they need, even if it cuts into their personal time, their family time, and out of their own pocket. Mm-hmm. And until we correct the payment schedule and get payment reform that acknowledges the great work that nurses are doing, we're going to continue to drive nurses out of the profession. And the Capitol was filled with nurses yesterday talking about the same sort of thing. And I was not able to attend this particular segment yesterday for the nurses, but there was a speaker speaking to a larger group saying to them, okay, all you brand new nursing students, how many of you expect to be working in the nursing field in a year? Lots of people raised their hand. How about in 5 years? How many of you expect to be at the bedside in 5 years? Not so many hands. 10 years. I mean, there's a problem, and I think if we move to payment reform that acknowledges the work that nurses are doing, you're not going to wind up burning out nurses and contributing to the nursing shortage problem that we have in the state. So there's lots of solutions that are being, lots of problems that are being fixed by this one solution. Thank you for bringing in this witness, Madam Chair.
Well, I didn't bring her, but I'm so glad she's here. Ms. Chesney?
Yes.
Did you have a comment?
I did. I just wanted to make a follow-up comment to one other casualty, so to speak, of our current payment system is I can assure you that in many of a clinic, if the costs for care are not being met by the reimbursement model, I don't think it's any surprise to any of you to think who might be the first to go from a clinic system. You can't, pardon me, you can't afford to have your providers leave, and therefore it's the nursing staff that gets cut, which further exacerbates the providers' work that they need to do and their sense of being overburdened. So it really does have a fallout effect all across clinical systems, all across Minnesota.
Any other questions? If not, why don't we hear from Dr. Bockwig? Is that how you say your name?
Correct.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Dr. Ben Bockwig. I'm an internal medicine physician and president of the North Clinic, which is a 50-physician multi-specialty group in Robbinsdale, Minnesota. And I want to talk a little bit today. I appreciate the opportunity to be here, and I wanted to talk a little bit today about what I consider a success story that we've had based on some payment reform that's already been embraced by the state of Minnesota, and then express my hopes for the future based on the potential that I see in payment reform. Our clinic is an active participant in the Minnesota Senior Health Options Program, or MSHO, program, and we've been able to develop programs for people at the other end of the age spectrum from what Ms. Chesney spoke about today, the geriatric group, where we see the same type of frailty and vulnerability that we see among the children in terms of being able to get care and access care and advocate for themselves. And we've been able to develop a program by being involved in a different type of reimbursement program, a risk program that allows us a pool of dollars to care for a population that has allowed us to build a very robust system of physician-driven care for patients in nursing homes, for patients in the community who are frail and elderly. One of the fastest growing segments of our population are the 80-plus-year-old patients who often fall into these programs. And we've been able to grow our program and establish it in a way that has allowed what I call concierge care for the frail elderly at really no cost to them. We have physicians who now are based at several of the nursing homes in our area. They care for over 1,000 patients, not all of whom are in the MSHO program, but because of the MSHO program and our participation, we've been able to put them and place them full-time at the nursing homes and allow them to be on-site and able to deliver excellent care both in for the long-term care patient, but also the short-stay patients who come directly from the hospital and are often cared for by the phone, even though they're very complex and in an acute stage in their illnesses. And we feel like it's improved the care for our patients dramatically. We've been working to try to extend the same type of a model into assisted livings, and we've been able to do that by helping create some new insurance products that allow us to bring this type of care to assisted living patients. So our clinic really sees the value in payment reform. We see it with our commercial insurance patients where we are based completely on visit-based care, or our straight Medicare patients where the same is true, that we struggle to be able to put the same kind of infrastructure in place because of the cost pressures that are on our system. We tend to have to focus on how to get people into the clinic, how to what people would describe as churning, how to work faster, how to try to get the most charges. And I think our clinic has a long history of being primary physicians for our patients, providing a medical home, we felt like, when it wasn't popular, and sticking to our guns about caring for our patients in outpatient and inpatient settings, and working to try to find payment reform to allow us to continue that is a critical part of my role as president. People have wondered whether payment reform will be the end of independent practice, and I would argue that without payment reform, the only thing that seems to be effective in terms of improving reimbursement is leverage that comes from being part of a big system. We know that with our current method, it isn't a level playing field, and that independent clinics tend to be paid several percent less than big system clinics, and so there's a tremendous pressure to move towards bigger clinics if we want to be competitive for physician providers. This is especially true in primary care, where we don't have the kind of procedural ability to generate the dollars that some of our procedural colleagues do, and therefore often systems supplement their primary care doctors. So I feel as if payment reform, giving us an opportunity to develop systems that provide efficient care with some potential upside for us if we do a good job with it, could actually be an important step in rescuing independent clinics. I think it would have to be structured in such a way that smaller players could participate, but I think that can be done without having to feel that this would drive all independents out of the system. We also hear that this is something that is feared in the rural areas, and I obviously Robbinsdale is a suburban area. We reach out into exurban areas, but I will say that our MSHO program has been one that we've been able to develop collaborative agreements to put in place in Aiken, Minnesota, and we have active conversations with Buffalo and St. Cloud physicians about doing a similar program in their area. So I think that these are things that can work not just in a metropolitan area. We know that some of these frail elderly patients, the highest concentrations of them are in the rural counties where we have a lot of elderly patients who've stayed in those counties and need health care and need quality care. So I would argue strongly that working towards this, in spite of the resistance that you'll face, would be of great value for the care of children, but also of the frail elderly. Thank you.
Are there questions for the doctor? I guess not. Thank you both for the work you do. We appreciate your taking time to come and share with us today. Assistant Commissioner Lights, did you want to come up to continue the presentation?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, again, for the record, my name is Scott Lights, and I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Health. My presentation today will be about the recommendations from the Transformation Task Force on Payment Reform, and I'll go over those now. The backdrop for some of the health reform discussions this year, I think, are well documented, and the committee is well aware of them. The fact is we have rising health care costs in the state that are outstripping growth in other parts of the economy. And our healthcare system, unfortunately, creates a relatively low value for the dollars that we spend and has misaligned incentives. And what we're also finding due to the rising healthcare costs is that private insurance coverage is continuing to erode in the state and that the number of uninsured in the state is increasing. Relative to the amount of money that we're spending on healthcare, healthcare quality is relatively low and it's unevenly distributed across our population. And then finally, the way that we pay for healthcare services leads to distortions in the types of healthcare that gets delivered. And it tends to concentrate on investment in high-margin services and probably underinvestment in low-margin services. And that's driven by the healthcare payment system that we have. Picking up on that theme, the current payment system has misaligned incentives. Our current system is based on individual services. It means that the more that you do, the more that you make. And the system currently has limited or no incentives for prevention, for care management, for quality of care, for innovation or for value. Many of the things that the previous testifiers said they'd like to do in the current system, but the current payment system simply doesn't support. On the consumer side, there's limited consumer incentive to choose providers based on their quality of care or the cost of care, because oftentimes there's limited information on price or and quality of care. And then finally, as I mentioned earlier, the incentives in the current system are to invest in high-margin services and to avoid those services such as primary care, which have relatively low margins. This challenge in payment reform is not in the way that we pay for health care is not something that's been noted only here in Minnesota. Many people have pointed out the shortfalls that exist. There's a longer quote here from the Commonwealth Commission on a High-Performing Healthcare System, which echoes this theme that the payments incentives that we have in our current healthcare system are simply misaligned, and that this encourages fragmented care, particularly for those who are chronically ill or fragile. In Minnesota, there are many who have also pointed this out. A couple quotes here, one from the Mayo Health Policy Center, which talk about the financial penalties and disincentives to offer certain types of care, such as preventive care, and incentives to offer expensive specialty care and procedures, again, oftentimes driven by the tyranny of the office visit and the way that we actually pay for care, which does incent higher margin services, which oftentimes add limited value, whereas some of the services that add a great deal of value at relatively low cost, such as preventive care and primary care, are not incented in the current system. And finally, the Physician Plan for a Healthy Minnesota talked real specifically about developing payment systems to support quality practice, so a theme that's echoed in here in Minnesota. The payment reforms that the Transformation Task Force recommended have a variety of overarching goals. In general, though, the main theme here was to put financial incentives in the right place to achieve higher quality care, lower health care cost, more consumer engagement in decision making, and then competition at levels of between health care providers and health plans to ensure an active marketplace. The task force then had some goals and recommendations in this area. The first was to empower individuals with information and give them choices around providers tied to responsibility. To improve coordination and management of care, especially for people with chronic illnesses and disease, to increase the transparency of the healthcare system, and to increase competition based on price and quality, to establish accountability for quality of care and for cost of services, so that allowing for flexibility and innovation, but also expecting accountability. And then to achieve and sustain necessary incentives in the system so that the system itself has the incentives to actually invent itself in a way that will support the delivery of care in the manner that many believe it should. The Transformation Task Force had recommendations on payment reform, and they talked about three stages of payment reform. The first stage involved more explicit payments for quality of care and efficiency. There is payment for quality today. Many providers are engaged with purchasers in projects such as Bridges to Excellence and other things which reward excellent care, reward care that is delivered and achieves good patient outcomes. The task force believe that's a good start and a good place to build from, and that more of that should occur so that, again, we start to align the incentives in the system. In stage two, the task force talked about improving and encouraging care coordination, particularly those with chronic conditions. This involved the establishment of care management fees for providers who meet standards to serve as medical homes, adjusting those fees to ensure that we account for the risk and severity of the population being managed, and then establishing standards that providers would have to meet to be a care management home. I think in stage two, the task force believed that it was important to include that payment for quality as part of stage two that was included in stage one, so that we, again, were incenting providers to deliver high-quality, low-cost, and efficient health care. And then there was a third level or stage that the task force talked about that had some overarching goals. The level three payment system really was about five things: improving the healthcare outcomes of Minnesotans as an overarching goal. To do that, it was the level three aims at improving the coordination and delivery of care for Minnesotans, creating a system of transparent price and quality to the marketplace, providing incentives for consumers to choose and use high quality and efficient healthcare providers, and then allowing providers, and most importantly, I would argue, allowing providers the opportunity to innovate and redesign their care delivery in ways that support high quality, low cost, high value healthcare. In stage three, primary care and large provider groups' cost to consumers will be based on their performance on total cost and quality. Under stage three, provider groups and care systems submit bids on the total cost of care. Patients choose provider groups and care systems based on cost and quality, and the payments to providers are on a fee-for-service basis, risk-adjusted based on the health of the population they manage. It's important to note that providers would be paid for every service that they deliver. This is not a capitation model. This is not a managed care model. This is a model where providers are paid for every service they deliver. They bid what their total cost of care would be, and then as they deliver care, the incentive will be to deliver it in low-cost, high-quality ways, but for every service they deliver, they will be paid. Another key element of Level 3 is that pricing is simplified under Level 3. Providers establish a single price for each of their services. That price is then paid by the market regardless of who the payer is. So it's a price set by the provider and paid by all payers. Plans and providers no longer would then need to negotiate because providers are setting plans. As Dr. Bockwig mentioned earlier, there's a strong incentive now to consolidate because the way that you get higher prices is by consolidating with other providers to align and negotiate the highest rate that is possible. So there's a strong incentive for primary care clinics, for rural clinics to align with larger systems so that they can negotiate higher rates. This takes it in the opposite direction. This says there is no need to consolidate to do that. In fact, there is an incentive now built in for you to be able to set your own price and to be able to set your price at the level that you feel is the appropriate level. Health plans would then structure benefits so that consumers would pay more for high-cost, low-quality providers, and the opposite being true for lower-cost, higher-quality providers. Within the total cost of care model, providers would also be able to establish transparent prices for baskets of services, such as maternity care and hip replacement, and this will increase the price and quality transparency overall in the marketplace. One question is, do all providers have to bid a total cost of care? And the answer is that not all providers are either of a size or a capacity to directly submit bids for total cost of care. Level 3 anticipates that some providers will choose to bid, but others will not. And for those not bidding on total cost of care, those providers will be paid based on their cost relative to other providers after adjusting for the severity and risk of their populations that they serve. So while they may not be bidding on total cost of care, they may be bidding on portions of care. They may be providing a single price to the marketplace, and that price would be paid by the market. What's anticipated then under Level 3 is that health plans will develop benefit structures based on the bids and the prices submitted by providers. Consumers will have incentives to use higher quality, lower cost providers through methods set up by health plans. This might involve value networks. This might involve tiering. This might involve reference price networks. And it might involve any number of things. We anticipate that there will be a great deal of innovation in the healthcare market, in the health plan marketplace, that will engage a variety of different benefit set structures, but likely some higher out-of-pocket costs for choosing those providers who are higher cost and lower quality.
Assistant Commissioner Senator Pretner Solon has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Assistant Commissioner Lights, this is probably the part that frightens my providers the most, and I'm not sure how to reassure them. And whether it's an integrated system or it's more rural model of system, there's great concern about how this would be implemented. And I think that people want to get paid for their services. They also don't want to price themselves out of the market. And it, as you understand, our system today is that people the providers have what it costs to deliver services, but the health plans pay about 70% of that or 60%. The state pays about 30% of that. I think pricing is going to be a very difficult problem, and it will make it even more difficult for those that aren't in an integrated system that don't already have all the pricing components there and still want to be competitive in the market. And so are there going to be any tools or assistance that is provided or any formulas that are going to be assisting people to be able to work toward this and to remain competitive as providers in the market?
Madam Chair, Senator Prettner-Solin, yes to your question on a variety of levels. The first is that it's anticipated that how the system will develop over a number of years, and the providers will begin to get information about their relative cost and quality as information is collected, whether through the Healthcare Transformation Organization, for example. They'll get information on the relative resource utilization, the prices and the utilization of services on providers. That information will be fed back to providers so that they – oftentimes now providers don't necessarily know how their prices line up relative to others. They don't necessarily know how their relative value, relative resource utilization lines up relative to other providers. So that information will be fed back to providers so that they can begin to understand how they're doing relative to other providers, begin to understand how they may want to price their products in a way or their services in a way that is that matches their actual resource utilization. The way the system is driven right now, there isn't a strong incentive for them to do that because it's all based on negotiation. And so the price that they set, to some degree, doesn't even necessarily bear any resemblance to what they actually get paid because it's sort of a price, and then they negotiate, and it's leverage versus leverage, and whoever is the biggest gets either the highest rate or the lowest rate. And under the current system, that tends to benefit large systems, large providers, and drives consolidation both on the health plan side and on the provider side. And so this moves in a different direction by saying that's not how we're going to do this. The price that you set is going to be your price, but there's going to be assistance provided to you as we move into that, as we move in that direction, via information being fed back to you about as a provider about what your prices are and how they line up relative to other providers, so that they can understand and start to move to that system, not in a black hole without having information, but with having information before we actually get to that point.
Okay, Madam Chair.
And Senator Prettner-Solin?
The other feedback I've received is, first of all, that it's a lot to bite off all at once, that you know, making these transitions for huge systems is very difficult to incorporate. And there's great concern about moving too fast. But I've also heard the concern that maybe Tier 3 should have been implemented first, and paying for the services that people actually provide rather than just the services they can charge for. If that were implemented first, it would be easier to move into or developing a cost analysis of what their services are.
Madam Chair, Senator Prettner-Solin, that's an interesting comment. I think the idea behind the staging of this, the logic kind of worked like this. There was a recognition that we've already built some infrastructure in the marketplace to pay for quality today. It's being done by health plans. It's being done by some larger self-insured purchasers. And that was a good starting place to build on. And so since that's already being done in the marketplace, we should expand on that. And also it starts to then develop the incentive for lower cost, higher quality care, because that's what's being rewarded in the paying for better quality that's in level one. The idea in level two, again, is building off the idea of the care coordination. And again, this is starting to happen. It's not as widespread as it should be or that it could be. And so the idea was also then that as we start to move in directions of being more explicit about payment for quality, that we should also move in the direction of taking those high-cost cases that we know exist in the chronically ill people and start to get in place structures that do a better job of managing their care. As those develop, And as those are expanded, it then provides an opportunity for those systems to think about total cost of care in a manner that they hadn't been able to in the past. So the idea here was to build on existing level one and level two, build on payment for quality, build on chronic on ensuring better care coordination for those who are chronically ill, so that as we move towards level three, we would have a base to build off of and an infrastructure already built so that people were already starting to provide that care coordination that's going to be so critical to making level three payment work.
Another question, Senator Lori. Then we'll let him go on with his.
Okay, we'll get to this quickly. But level three is a very big issue and causing a good deal of discussion, as is appropriate. And I'm some of the things you said made it sound like even in level three, it's still going to be a largely fee-for-service driven option. And when I was reading specifically on page 821. In level and item 3A4, item K, you know, one option is for the actual payments to providers to be continued based on the current fee for service and episode driven. Other potential options would be for a newly defined basket of care or a health care home model. And I think that, you know, I mean, there's probably a good deal of comfort to some people in thinking in terms of the fee for service option and maybe. I don't know if that's driving those comments, but I think that we should really start be pushing to think about baskets of care and the healthcare home options to really encourage a new way of thinking about delivering care. And these are issues that we really need to be asking serious questions about, but really do provide a good deal of potential for our nurses to be operating at the top of their license, you know, bringing the entire interdisciplinary team into the approach. And if it's driven off of our current fee-for-service system, I think that it might not bring those really high-level potentials of incorporating everybody into the care team. The St. Mary's Duluth Clinic chronic heart failure model, the Diamond project that we're talking about, the services that drive the savings in those models are not incorporated in our current fee-for-service system. And so while it's uncomfortable to talk about, I think we really do need to be pushing and seeing if we can make these baskets or the healthcare home model work. And so I did have some.
Senator Lori, there also would be the option for a low-cost, high-quality clinic that is not part of an integrated system to be paid on a per member per month basis for their portion of the care if they choose to be paid that way. So that's the important thing that people need to understand. Providers are going to have a lot to say about the flexibility of the payments they receive. Yes, they will be held accountable for their price. But, you know, if you open the paper and it tells you that you can buy grapes at the store this week for 39 cents a pound, and you got to the store and found out it was $1.39 a pound, you'd be pretty upset. People will be held accountable for their price, but they will be given the chance to change their price periodically so that if they didn't, you know, if they're not charging the right price, they'll be able to change and raise their price or lower their price at various periods of time. So I don't think providers should be afraid of having more flexibility about how they get paid. If they're afraid about being accountable for their price, well, right now they get a price. They don't get as much to say about it maybe as they'd like, but they still are given a price, and they have to live with that price. So it's not that different from the system we have today where they get a price and they have to provide the services for that price.
Adam
Senator Lori?
Yes, but if we, my point is more that the price needs to be paid for the broader set of services that are not encompassed in our current fee-for-service
system. I agree with
system.
You.
And no, providers need to embrace accountability in terms of cost and value, but it is going to be scary. I mean, it's anytime we approach major reform, it's going to be scary, and I just want to make sure that we do push people to be getting outside of their comfort level a little bit and really talking about the pieces of this that have the potential to bring the true reform to the system that I think everybody understands is long overdue.
Senator Pretner Solon.
Madam Chair, this is an aside, but I think it's very important. We need a system then, and I don't know what that system will be, if it'll be on a web or what, of updating what those prices are on an ongoing basis, because the books that the plans put out now, providing the list of providers, are often 3, 5, 7 years old and aren't at all current with what the providers are.
Well, under this payment reform, the state would be providing a website with all the prices, and those materials would be available to everyone at the time they would choose what they're going to do for their systems of care for that period of time. So the state would be bringing together not only the price transparency, but the quality transparency, which I happen to think is equally important, and that's why I don't think you could start with level 3. You know, we had a presentation yesterday that showed that we're at 11% on average in terms of quality for our diabetic care. Well, that's not exactly a ringing endorsement for a lot of quality out there. And you know, if somebody's going to be managing me in terms of providing me a medical home, and I have diabetes, I sure want them to be doing better than 11%. So this will give people time to improve their quality as well as trying to think about ways that they could become more efficient in their delivery system, I think. Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not sure how much time we have. I have so many questions that I will just ask a couple of them, and then maybe the assistant
right.
commissioner.
Right, and we do have more presentation. We do have other people who want to come and right. help answer questions and help.
Well, and I would even appreciate the chance to just sit down privately and go through some of these questions that maybe other members already feel comfortable
sure.
that they have the answers to. But just a couple of questions, because I'm trying to envision how this is going to work in my community, where we have one clinic and all the doctors work for that clinic, and then we have a different hospital. So I guess we have some doctors who work there, but all the primary care physicians are basically working for one place. Is that going to be are individual doctors going to be appearing on a website where people are going to be looking at those individual ratings of each doctor? Or is it going to be the clinic, in which case it's kind of irrelevant because we've only got one clinic to go to anyway? So a basic question I have is how this is going to work in rural Minnesota, where almost every community just has one choice of health care provider, not individual physicians, but facilities.
And we do have someone that's going to testify just exactly on that question. So maybe it might be good to hold that question for just... if you can manage to do that for just a little bit here.
And Senator Berglund, the other kind of overarching concern that I have, or question perhaps, is that we are putting, it seems like, complete emphasis on pay for performance for the doctor and responsibility for the patient. And while there may be some good things about making sure we get value out of our healthcare system and that we expect people to be responsible, where is the spotlight in terms of the plan and looking at what they're offering or what, I mean, is there going to be something on these computers that's going to tell us what their loss ratio is and how they're spending their money and how much, you know, what their percentage of administrative costs are and that type of thing? Are we going to be scrutinizing that as well as we look for cost savings, or are we just focusing on the medical community and the patients?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I think the goal here is to hold the entire system accountable. Your question is a good one, and there are certainly there are accountability measures that we are expecting from consumers and patients here. We're expecting some from providers. And at the health plan level, they'll have a new role, and it'll be a different role than they have today. It'll be about they'll still be holding risk, but they'll also have a responsibility to help help steer their patients and the people who are enrolled in their health plans find and use high-quality providers to help encourage care management for those and support the care management of those individuals. And we do envision a system which is much more transparent than it is today. And to the extent that there is information that should be available that's relevant to the transparency of the system, that information should be available as well. So to your question, we do envision a system that is much more transparent than it currently is on things such as loss ratios. There is some information on that currently available, and we would envision a system which keeps pushing on transparency to ensure that that's there, both around price and quality at provider levels, but also at price and quality at health plan levels. So, yes, I mean, there is a system and expected that the entire system would become much more transparent than it is today.
Why don't you continue?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to close up then, what are the impacts then that are expected then from the payment reform? Well, there are several, and they are really talking about changing the fundamental incentives and direction of the system. Provider incentives change from the current system incentives that are in place for rewarding higher volume to a system that rewards better care management and better outcomes. You're actually going to be rewarding things that produce outcomes rather than volume. There will be strong incentives in the system to redesign care delivery to do things that aren't currently supported today. There's a classic example that I think has already been mentioned this morning of the avoidance of rehospitalization for heart failure patients who, under a payment system that currently doesn't support that avoidance of rehospitalization, since you get paid for rehospitalization, you don't get paid for avoidance. This system would actually reward the avoidance rather than the rehospitalization. So instead of losing money by providing better care, providers would actually share in the savings. And finally, and importantly, it provides an opportunity for providers to innovate. We heard earlier from Dr. Bockwig about how the current system doesn't support the innovations that he would like to implement in his clinic. This payment system would actually move in the direction providing those incentives to innovate and find different ways and better ways to deliver care. One question that's been asked is, how does this payment reform proposal differ from some of the previous attempts to control costs and increase quality? Under previous attempts, there was a focus more on restricting services that providers could order without prior approval, things such as prior authorization, and that this restricted the provider's ability to deliver care, and the way that it held down costs was by restricting that. It also relied on negotiated prices, which has led to this cycle that we certainly see in the market today of increased consolidation as providers consolidate, plans consolidate, all in an attempt to leverage better prices. It's an endless cycle that continues both in the urban area of the state as well as in greater Minnesota. Under Level 3, this is fundamentally different. First of all, providers set their own prices, and it's a single price for all payers. It's the price that they set to the market, and it's the market that pays that price. Providers control and set the amount of their bid. And then in consultation with their patients, those providers are in charge of deciding what care should be delivered to their patients. Price and quality information will be available to help guide consumer choices. And providers who are successful at finding innovative care delivery models will benefit financially instead of under the current system where they are penalized for finding those innovative care delivery models. So in summary, the key attributes of this reformed healthcare system include there is not insurance risk being taken by providers, and providers will, as I mentioned, be paid for each service they deliver. But providers will have some risk for delivering value to their customers. There will be alignment of incentives. I went through what those are and how we align better. The system aligns the incentives much better than under the current system to deliver better health outcomes. Importantly, it restores the important role of primary care. It elevates the role of primary care and elevates the role of care coordination and the important role that primary care physicians play. And it builds on the current infrastructure. This isn't about creating something new from scratch. This is taking a current infrastructure that we have and aligning the incentives so that we can build on that infrastructure to make it a better healthcare payment system than we currently have. In the interest of time, Madam Chair, I'm simply going to skip through the next couple of slides and close with this one, which is that we do believe there are some potential efficiencies that will be produced by the payment reform system that's being proposed here. We believe it will certainly result in better patient outcomes, and also some sources of potential savings. It's likely that consumers will shift to lower cost, higher quality providers, and that there will be some increased price competition on prices among providers. The state employee group experience shows that consumers and providers are sensitive to the prices that they put out to the marketplace. And so there is some incentive for people to think about where they're getting their care and for providers to think about the prices that are being sent and how they might be able to deliver care in a more cost-effective manner. And that provider incentives to redesign the delivery of care will be the incentives for that to happen will be changed under the current system so that providers have incentives to deliver care in a manner that's high quality and low cost and do some of the innovations that they would like to be able to do but are restricted from doing under the current system. Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity to present today.
Senator Pretner-Solon.
Madam Chair, one question to your last points, Assistant Commissioner Lights. If payment is based on quality rather than volume, and if people are going to gravitate to the higher quality providers, is that going to ration care? Because there won't be enough providers, possibly. Especially in the rural markets where people don't have the volume, they don't have the number of the various types of diseases to take care of. Are they going to be able to acquire the same types of quality or provide the same types of quality care and have in order to be able to compete?
Madam Chair, Senator Pretner-Solon, yes, they absolutely will be able to do that. And the way that will work is that there will be incentives initially for people to gravitate to models of care that deliver high-quality outcomes at low cost. What will then happen is that providers who are perhaps not in at the current state being able to deliver care which is as of high quality or as low cost will see those models, will eventually adapt their models in ways that will support high-quality, low-cost care so that the system itself starts to move in that direction. And the nice thing about the way the system is aligned and under this payment reform is that those providers who do well and figure out innovative ways to care for people that deliver better outcomes will initially be rewarded for that through patient volume and market share. Other providers will certainly see that and adapt the way that they're doing care in ways that to compete for those patients. And so the system itself begins to evolve in a very positive way so that care is improved across the board. And that's the sort of incentive that's built into this system.
And, Senator, I think just before you came in, we had some testimony from Dr. Ben Bockwig, and he is a geriatrician that practices in Robbinsdale. And he was talking about how the fact that the MSHO program pays them both with Medicare and Medicaid dollars on a per-person, per-member, per-month basis, that they've been able to do these very innovative things, getting a physician out in a nursing home where they have patients, providing on-site staffing in assisted living facilities. They've been able to have much better outcomes. And they are now discussing ways that this could be done in Buffalo, Minnesota, and Annandale in those clinics. So I think that's exactly what Assistant Commissioner Lights has said, that those that figure it out, help others, because everyone's interested in improving the outcomes for their patients.
Madam Chair, in concept, I see it, and it provides a very hopeful picture in future. I think people are scared about the implementation.
Well, it is going to require people to change the way they do things, but I just have to say this again. I believe that if we don't change the way we do things, we're going to see the diminishment of care in rural Minnesota because primary care is so undervalued in our system today. We're just not going to have enough supply of primary care providers, and the first place you'll get shortages is rural Minnesota. Other questions for Assistant Commissioner Lights? If not, then let's take some of our other testifiers. Dr. Charlie Fazio and Tom Forsyth, if you both want to come up, that would be fine. And I don't know if you've arranged for who should go next, but whichever one of you wants to go next, that would be fine.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. We had not arranged who would go first, so we're going to make that up, but I'll be making up a lot of things because while I compliment Assistant Commissioner Lights for his presentation, I don't know that I can add a lot to it. He did suggest that I talk about those same things, so right now my prepared remarks are out the window.
If you can just say your name for the record, for the tape, if anybody ever listens to it.
My name is Tom Forsyth. I am Vice President of Communications at General Mills, and I'm also the company's health care policy guy. Now, I realize that those two jobs do not go together, and I probably shouldn't even be here, but I've been at this health policy thing for like 20 years. If I have a talent in this arena, it is that I have spent 20 years understanding conversations like the ones you're having now, and I can try to convert that into language that the average person can understand. So I've been at this a long time. As I say, I helped create the Buyers Healthcare Action Group. Much of what we're talking about here today in Level 3 was the payment system that we implemented in the Buyers Healthcare Action Group. I can talk to you about that if you like. I also had the honor of serving on the Minnesota Healthcare Commission after the passage of Minnesota Care, and for the last several months as a member of the Governor's Healthcare Transformation Task Force. So I was asked to speak about payment reform and how that might work, and I'd be happy to talk about that in layman's terms at the end. That's the part that's probably out the window. I'd like to say just a couple of things about General Mills. We are the sixth largest food company in the world. We have about $13 billion in sales. We market in 100 countries around the world. We have employees in all 50 states, about 28,000 in all. About 17,000 of those are in the United States. And with employees, retirees, and family members, we insure 55,000 people in the United States. We've been at healthcare a very long time. We chair and have chaired the National Business Group on Health. We're a member of LeapFrog. We're a member of the Coalition to Advance Healthcare Reform. We're a member of the Better Healthcare Coalition with Walmart and SEIU. We're a member of Divided We Fail with SEIU and the Business Roundtable. We're in everything we can think of to try to drive healthcare reform. We spent last year approximately $110 million on healthcare, which would represent about 10% of net earnings. And if that sounds like a lot to you, it's actually not. Most of our peers in America would probably trade places with us in a heartbeat because those are pretty enviable numbers. And most companies would want to take our system if they could because we have clearly been managing our healthcare costs in every way we can possibly think of for at least 20 years. We have had managed care, drug formularies. We have company doctors, company nurses, company nurse practitioners, company physicians' assistants. We operate company-owned clinics. We've been operating wellness programs for 25 years, and our programs, we think, are state-of-the-art. We have had consumer-driven health plans since they were created. We have had healthcare spending accounts. We charge higher premiums for smokers. We operate smoking cessation programs. We operate weight loss programs. We do case management, disease management, perhaps as well as anybody. We refer to national centers of excellence, and that's why we've been pretty successful. In fact, as I said, we've been doing pretty well. Over the last 5 years, we've held our costs more or less in line with the rate of inflation, actually a little under 3% increase per year. So that's pretty good. Nevertheless, we think we need to do healthcare reform, not just in Minnesota but nationally, and we think that the thing we have to do is change the way we pay for healthcare, the way we deliver healthcare, because much of it just doesn't work. The way we shop for healthcare or don't shop, the way we insure or don't insure Americans, the way we pay for the care of the uninsured, the basis on which providers compete, the way consumers choose providers, the entire thing is kind of a mess. Now, there are many important aspects of the Transformation Task Force report, public health recommendations, insurance reforms, coverage mechanisms. I think they're all important, and you should consider the entire package, but the parts that I think are the most important are delivery reform and payment reform, those parts we're talking about today, because I believe the two biggest problems in healthcare today are the problem of the uninsured and the problem that healthcare costs too much, and it is costing more every day. And I believe these two problems are inextricably linked. I think that one is the principal cause of the other. So we need to change this. We need pricing that is transparent to consumers. We need to be able to assess quality. We need to engage consumers at that level, but today that's not possible. Pricing is not transparent. In fact, it is largely unavailable. Quality is difficult to assess. And if you don't have those two points, you cannot judge value. That's before you can consume, and it's very hard to judge value after you consume. So we believe that we need to change healthcare delivery, leverage a properly oriented, aligned, functioning market to drive efficiency and reward quality and superior performance in a value-based, value-driven, consumer-centered healthcare system. And that's what we tried to do on the transformation task force with levels 1, 2, and 3. I don't know that I can add too much to what Assistant Commissioner Light said, but I will say this. I would welcome your questions. I can explain this like a layman, and that might be helpful. And we did operate level 3. I do understand level 1 and 2. The reason we put these together in this way is because we need to be able to evolve from the system we have today to the system we would like to have, where consumers can assess price, where they can see quality, where they can judge value. And we need to have an evolutionary model that will get us to that point, that builds on the strengths of our current system, strengthens its weaknesses, and makes this entire thing work better for consumers. And with that, I'll turn it over to my friend, Dr. Fazio.
Good morning. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Charlie Fazio. I'm a licensed physician in Minnesota. I currently have a job as the chief medical officer at Medica. I don't typically share my practice experience, but I think it's important for this morning. I spent 10 years in Onamia, Minnesota, a town of about 650 people, 10 years in St. Cloud, Minnesota, slightly bigger community, 50 to 75,000 people, and then also practiced in the Twin Cities. So the experience, especially in the two smaller communities, will become germane as we talk about this all a little bit. I'll also try to be clear when I'm talking as a physician who has practiced. When I'm talking about my experience in the health plan, they're on the dark side all these last 7 years completely without practice. And then when I'm talking about a transformation task force point of view, I had the privilege to serve with Tom and Senator Rosen and Senator Berglund and others on that group. If I can spend a little bit of time on the three levels of payment. Level one is about pretty standard fee-for-service medicine and pay-for-performance. We're already there. We can do it better than we're doing. We could do it with fewer measures, more consistent measures across plans, better feedback. But level one is out there for the most part and has helped to raise awareness about quality of care, as well as helped to support with the pay-for-performance payments some of the infrastructure that's necessary in order to change how you deliver care. That was why we got into it at Medica to begin with. Level two is about the sort of delivery that Ms. Chesney was talking about. How do we get the office visit out of the way of how you deliver care? And we're getting to some of that. At Medica, we have six pilots going on how to pay care management fees and how to remove the obligation that the only way you change money between an insurer and a delivery system is through an office visit and a claim form. We take disease management monies, that's what we used to use them for, and we give them to the organizations to manage people with chronic disease. These six organizations all don't do it the same way, but they do it up to standard so that we have reason to assume that they will get the outcomes that these patients should expect of the systems they're in. So they don't have to do it the same way, but they need to have certain pieces in place in order to move forward. Neither one nor two should necessarily mean more money in the system. We can't afford more money in the system. We have to differentiate how we pay. We have to get people healthier and reward the sort of outcomes that come along with levels one and two. It's level three, though, that's really transformational, and it would be disappointing if we thought about payment reform and played with one and two, which more tweak the system that's there, and stopped short of level three, which says, let's get out of the way. Let's reward people actually who innovate, because by thinking of care differently, you probably get people healthy and you should come in below this bid that everybody has talked about. Dr. Bockwig gave you a great example of how working with some people who can be on the highest demand end of the spectrum in healthcare, how you can take a fixed payment, keep those people healthy, and often cases keep them in the community rather than in a facility, and still make financial ends meet in the course of delivering that kind of care. That's how, on the Transformation Task Force, we were thinking about level three payment. How do you think about
Dr.
care
differently? If I can just interrupt you for a minute to add to what you're saying here, because really the only people that Dr. Bockwig gets paid for in a per member per month way are the people who are both on Medicare and Medicaid. And yet I know from talking to him and other doctors who are caring for geriatric patients that they make enough off of it to be able to provide the same services to people who are on Medicare who are not on Medicaid in terms of being able to provide more care management services that are not paid for through the Medicare system. So I thought that was just important. Not only do they manage to pay for what the services are that they're providing through the system, they manage to pay for more people to get the services.
Correct. Thank you for that addition. And I can, Madam Chair, confirm that it's absolutely true in Dr. Bockwig's practice as well as in other practices where we as the insurer help to support practices that are dealing with patients in that program. I think all of this to be successful needs a supportive structure. It needs the measurement that we've referred to before. It needs for people to understand whether or not they've been successful with something that's objective. It also needs insurance design that's supportive. So how do we encourage people to participate in these care systems? How do we encourage people to make good lifestyle decisions? How do we get employers to think about care the way General Mills thinks about care, as having patients be active participants in all phases and giving them the incentives and the structure to do that? A couple comments about rural issues, because I know it's come up before here. As an insurer, I can tell you the risk-adjusted total cost of care for people who get their care at any given community where Medica has patients all over the state. And I can tell you that the risk-adjusted total cost of care, if we remove the insurance risk, remove the catastrophes, remove anything that distinguishes one group from the other on the usual things that we compare in healthcare, whether you're rural or suburban or urban is not what drives the risk-adjusted total cost of care for a patient. This is about how people think about care, how creative they want to be, and what attention they pay to patients and to the people outside of their practice who see patients. Now, I know you can't always control that, but think about your own experiences in healthcare. Think about family physicians who cared about all of you as a person and all of your interactions versus family physicians who were more about the 10 minutes they were going to spend that day dealing with whatever was going on. Think about specialists the same way. Think about hospitals the same way. The best family physicians and the general internists, the primary care people in all walks of licensure, who do the best job are the people who look at the whole picture and who help guide you to those people who are the highest quality, even if we don't have the public measures of those quality, who know the specialists that are efficient, who know the specialists that send you back to your primary care clinic with good instructions on what should happen next, who know the hospitals that are interested in getting you well and then moving you through the next transition so that you get back to your normal state of health as quickly as you can. So risk-adjusted total cost of care, which is what Level 3 is about, is as much about the people and the front lines, and not all of them need to be doctors, and not all of them are doctors, especially in rural communities where they've embraced mid-levels and other practitioners for a long, long time. It's not about where you are. It's more about the philosophy you bring to practice. I can tell you that the group I worked with in Onamia is as competitive as any group in the state on their risk-adjusted total cost of care, and it has to do with their practice philosophy. They were three people when I was there, and they're six people now, and they do a wonderful job even though they don't provide all the care in Onamia, but they help convince patients about what care they ought to get as they move about the community. And I think in other communities around the state, you'll find variations of that. You'll also find people who care less about the total patient, and that's going to change over time. It's going to be forced to change by some of the reform we're talking about. As I quit, I would think it's been obvious as you read the report, the task force thought there were no magic bullets. If there were one thing to do that would make it better, we'd have done it. I think the report holds together as a total package of what we need to do as a community to move healthcare along. And I would encourage you, as you think about payment reform, one and two are tweaks on a system that's broken. They are evolutions to help people understand three and to help get ready for three. Think about how two helps a practice get ready for three. We've already got a lot of this in place. I'll go back to my insurer hat for a while. We do level one. We have six groups in level two. By year's end, I assure you, we will have three groups in level three no matter what happens, because this is what has to happen for the community. We're not going to lower healthcare costs if we don't change how we pay for it and change the incentives. So appreciate the chance to be here. Very much appreciated the chance to be part of the task force, and would be happy if there's time to try to answer questions.
There is time. Senator Olson, now do you want to follow up on your question that you asked earlier?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, because everything that everyone has said today sounds wonderful, but it doesn't give me anything close to the detail that I feel that I would need to really envision how this is going to work, what the criteria are going to be that would allow a clinic or hospital in my community to be in one or the other of these payment levels so that they can have an opportunity to judge if this is going to mean more or less money for them, and if they're going to be able to be competitive, or how, as a practical matter, people in my community are supposed to be expected to shop for their care and shop for doctors. So I'm envisioning a typical person in my community, and I tend to have a higher number of seniors than on average for the state. And I have probably, I'm not sure if half the people who live in my community even have a computer. But let's just assume this person has a computer in their home but isn't particularly, many seniors are not that comfortable doing much more than, well, I don't want to generalize because some are very astute at this, but I know from my own personal family experience between my parents and my in-laws, some are very comfortable with the computers, others don't want to have anything to do with it. So how is this going to work, and what information are they going to find, and how is this going to be, how are the doctors in my community going to be rated? Are they individually rated? And is this person supposed to then be able to go in and individually pick a doctor? Because I can tell you that the doctors in my community, their practices are full, you know, just based on word of mouth in terms of the doctors people want to see. Most of them that people feel are good value right now are full. So it's not like we just have the luxury of picking which doctor we want to go to and see that person anyway. So how is that going to work on a practical matter? As a practical matter.
So, Madam Chair and Senator Olson, I wonder if we could split up our response, and if Tom wants to talk about the choice piece and a rural community, I'll try to take a stab at the clinical part of it.
Okay. Madam Chair, Senator Olson, the way that this would look to your consumer is if they were actually all the way at level three, which they wouldn't be immediately, wouldn't have to get there immediately, but we would want to see them move in that direction, is that they would be able to see what the total cost of care for them would be, probably with their same doctor, because they're probably not going to go to a neighboring community. They may be very happy with their doctor, but they'd be able to judge and see how that cost of care, X dollars for the whole year, compares with other doctors in other communities. So there's a bit of a basis of competition there in that the clinic in your community would see how it compares with clinics in other communities. And that would begin to be transparent. So a bit of a competition level on total cost of care from community to community if you only have one clinic. It's up to the clinic and the doctors as to how they want to go forward. There are multiple ways to proceed. There is no one model that has to be adopted. It likely would be at the clinic level. There isn't a great deal of difference between this doctor and that doctor if they're practicing in the same practice and choose to do that. But if they chose not to do that, there could be a difference. So it doesn't require that they all do it at the clinic level, but that's the most likely. And in your situation, that's almost certainly what would occur. So then you would see a total price for the year. You'd be able to see how that compares to other neighboring communities. You'd also see measures of quality. Now, if your clinic was very good in that comparison, they may actually attract customers from other communities. If they were less good, they might lose customers to other communities. And if they were in the middle and everyone was very happy, it may continue very similarly. But now the clinic would understand the value proposition. They would be pricing for a total cost of care, and they would be compensated on that basis so that they could be compensated for things that today they're not, like care management. And that would not cost them money. And they could have different mix of providers so that they might be more efficient. They might actually wind up making more money in such a scenario because their margin might increase because they become more efficient. And then they could decide whether or not to pass that along in the form of a more competitive price or whether they wanted to make a greater profit. Similarly, it could be the opposite. It could be that they would be pressured on their margin and other competitors might have a better price, in which case they would be forced to look back at their own operation and say, could we do this better? Are we doing it the way it should be? Could we be more efficient? Is there a way to innovate? And we want to be able to allow all those things to occur where they should occur, which is among the group of providers who are providing care to consumers, because that's the right place for the basis of competition.
So, Madam Chair and Senator Olson, from the clinical point of view, I agree completely with Tom's remarks. There might not be as much choice, although I think we'll be surprised over time that there might actually be some movement between communities. But it's on the clinical side where there's an opportunity to evolve from the model that Ms. Chesney described earlier to the model that Dr. Bockwig described, even in a rural community. So you have these two or three doctors that work in the only clinic in town, and they work hard, and everybody wants to see their favorite in that group. And those doctors, at the end of the day, look through the patient lists, look through the lab results, and stay till 6 or 7 or 8 and try to get the work done that doesn't get done in the course of the visit and doesn't get paid for. If you talked about switching to level 2 payment in a group like that, let's assume that they had a system to know who all the people in the practice are with diabetes so they could call them back when they needed to come back and to monitor the labs on the people with diabetes. They're doing this stuff anyway, and it's not a big leap to get them to the point where they're managing this sort of in some kind of a database, manual or otherwise. But then they're paid a care management fee because they show they know how to do this to take care of people with chronic disease. Suddenly, not everything has to happen in the course of a visit, and suddenly not everything has to happen with those two or three doctors. They're able to hire a nurse practitioner or another advanced practice nurse or a dietitian or a pharmacist or whatever it is they think, whoever it is they think they need to bring skills to that community to remove the burden. The biggest mistake we've made over the course of time with medicine, as talented as doctors are, is having doctors do everything. We've got to move doctors to taking decisions and making decisions and implementing plans for the sickest of people and let everybody else practice to the level of their license and to the level of their skill set. And it's everybody's fault for how we've let the payment system come up over time. And if we get out of the way, I think there's a chance for that practice actually to be even more satisfying, probably expand its scope, because of what those doctors would be able to do on a different model. And I actually think they could be more successful.
Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Has anyone calculated the cost of doing all the pay-for-performance testing, both by the plans and by the physicians who are having to, or the medical community that's having to fill out all these things, as well as coming back and evaluating and risk adjusting or whatever it is you're doing. I mean, you're talking about a huge new area of administration, and obviously we're trying to save costs, and that's the stated goal, as well as improving care. But there's a cost in doing that. Shouldn't we know what that cost is, and has that been measured?
Madam Chair and Senator Grossman, it's a great question. I think at the highest level, if we think about health care costs on any given dollar that's in the health care market in Minnesota, about 90% of it goes to health care and about 10% of it goes to administration. I don't think we're talking about adding a lot, if anything, net to the 10% to expand our measurement to be able to do this risk-adjusted total cost of care analysis, especially because some of this would be done instead of some other things we're currently doing. And I think it was the task force's opinion that the ability to slow the rate of rise of the 90% was by far the more important portion of what we were doing. But I don't have exact numbers for you on the different pieces there.
Well, and we are measuring everybody now for something. You know, community measurements got every group practice in the state in their system, and they're measuring them against the ICSI standards. So it isn't like we're starting from scratch. We have those costs already built into our system, and, you know, community measurements is paying for the chart reviews that they're doing already, so it's not like we're adding that to the system. Mr. Forsyth?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I'd like to respond to that, too, if I could, because I'd just like to give you a little reassurance. Once upon a time, this was a real serious question, like a hurdle that we didn't have an answer for yet. That is no longer the case. It can be better, and there's a lot we can improve upon, and there are some areas where it's still weak. But we know quite a lot. So this risk adjuster has already been built. It works. We know exactly how it works, and it has had a very thorough testing of many, many years in a live environment. Doing this exact level 3 payment model, adjusting payments to bring people in on their bid, I can assure you that that works. As for quality measures, we know quite a lot, and it's only getting better. And we also know where we want to improve. So when you get a statistic like 11% of cases are receiving optimal diabetes care, that's because we have defined what it is, and we can measure performance against that set of optimal measures to see whether or not you're getting that care. So we set out to do these once upon a time. We set out to do these one at a time. The very first one we ever did was urinary tract infections. So there was a time when nothing existed. Now, because of ICSI, which I am a huge fan of, without ICSI, this thing didn't really work, we have set clinical standards for the community, and we have measures against which we can compare quality. And so we know a lot more than we think. And then I just have to assure you, on this risk adjuster, that part absolutely works.
Another question, Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So it sounds like the cost savings we're going to be getting, and I keep hearing, you know, having people practice at the top of their license and something about phone calling in and that type of thing. And I understand that there are monitoring things that are appropriate, you know, without putting patients at risk. But I wonder about, you know, managed health care at one point is really, in my opinion, responsible for why we only get 6 minutes with our primary care physician, and why we have the whole pay-for-performance push, although we weren't calling it that then and we weren't testing, but we were, as a whole, ratcheting down the amount of care we were willing to give people to make it more so-called value-oriented. Then we found out that there were lots of issues that that caused because people weren't having the time to spend with their doctor that they needed and the time to coordinate and the things that doctors would normally have done. Now we're recognizing that that was harmful, I think, in terms of not just patients' well-being, but also the cost of care because people aren't getting the attention they need. But at the same time, it sounds like we're going to try to find value in the system through some things that I still am concerned about, whether they're going to be sort of rationing care, like we're going to pay a doctor or a practice more if they're not allowing patients to come in and actually spend time in visits, or we're going to pay an equal amount for someone just to call someone on the phone. You know, I see so many potentials for abuse here that are not going to be good, with when, especially when you're talking about baskets of care. And that's kind of a capitated thing. And then we spend money measuring to make sure that that's not being abused and that patients actually are being seen or not be turned away, and risk adjusting so that we don't disincent people from seeing the problematic patients. So we're going through a lot of administrative hoops to try to, why don't we just pay in a straightforward way a greater amount for the things we know that work if we've already done this analysis, and a less amount for the things that don't work? Wouldn't that be much simpler?
Mr. Forsyth?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, first of all, there's like 50 questions in there, and I'm not sure I can address them all. I could if I could remember them, but I started writing them down very late. Let me just say a couple of things. We get what we get because this is how the system is designed. Here's another maxim for you. Follow the money. You know, it's a line from a movie, but it's absolutely true. The way we pay is the reason we deliver care the way we deliver it. At the core of all this, and I thought it was very excellently said, actually, earlier this morning, the tyranny of the office visit is one of the problems. So your very last point was, if we know these things work, why don't we just pay for them? And, of course, that's exactly right. That's why we want to do this, because we do know these things work, and we have to find a different way to pay for them, because that's not how the system is set up today. It is set up on the basis of CPT codes, usually driven by office visits or procedures provided. But if you wanted to provide care that we do know works for a diabetic or for congestive heart failure that doesn't involve coming into the office and running lab tests, you can't get paid. Well, that's just wrong, and this is what we're trying to attack. So the portion of level 3, or even the care management fee in level 2, is to try to drive towards that direction where you can provide higher quality care on a, I hesitate to say the word integrated, but on a total basis for the patient that should be provided, and we have to find a way to pay for it. If we can't find a way to pay for it, here's another saying for you, if you keep doing what you're always done, you're going to keep getting what you always got. And that's exactly true in healthcare. If we keep doing this the way we're doing it, we're going to keep getting what we get today. What we get today, no idea what the price is. No control whatsoever on volume. So one quick story. Paul Elwood tells this story. He was negotiating with the head of the American Medical Association when they passed Medicare for the very first time in the Nixon administration. And AMA had fought this tooth and nail. And it came down to this. They said, they were having this conversation. They said, so you're going to fix our prices. The government is going to tell us what you're going to pay for what we do. And Paul Elwood said to the head of AMA, yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. And he said, but you're not going to fix the volume. And he said, that's right. And he said, well, I think we can live with that. The reason we have what we have today is because of how we pay. When I visited with Secretary Levitz, I said, you know, you could fix this because the government's payment mechanisms that are, we're all driven off of Medicare and Medicaid and the CPT code system, that really is the issue. So the reason why I'm so enthusiastic about payment reform is because if we can't find a way to pay for these things differently, we won't be delivering them differently, and we will keep getting what we always got. Two more things on rationing. This is kind of the opposite of rationing, because what you should be able to get is the care that you couldn't get under the other system. And you should be getting total cost of care. And you really don't make more money by providing less, because eventually then your customer will leave. You make more money by providing great care that your consumer values for the price, and therefore you attract more customers and make more money. So it's all about driving value. So I think it really should be the opposite of rationing. In fact, I think you'll see people compete on service delivery. We'll see services as the basis of competition. How well you take care of people and how well you communicate will now be one of the things that consumers choose on. So I think it should actually work the opposite.
Dr. Fazio?
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, two quick points to sort of reinforce Tom's comments, all of which I agree with. The conversation that as an insurer we have most often with provider groups and hospitals is, how much of an increase am I going to get in my revenue over the last time we negotiated our contract? And when they propose a percentage, I can guarantee you it's rarely single digits. We can't keep talking about revenues in healthcare. As long as we keep talking about revenues and increases in revenues over the last contract, we're going to keep getting exactly what we're getting. We have to start talking about efficiency and outcomes and what people really need. Whenever we start to talk about efficiency, the underuse question and the rationing question is prime, as it should be. I very much appreciate that concern, and I think in other models and in other situations it has been an issue. But when you're talking actually about getting paid to innovate underneath a financial target, it really does bring out the creativity and practices. And I can guarantee you that Dr. Bockwig's patients, that's actually a capitated model. It's not a risk-adjusted total fee-for-service. It's a risk-adjusted capitation. You won't find more satisfied patients than the patients in the MSHO program at the North Clinic. They just love the attention that they get and the different people who reach out to them and the fact that there's a team that takes care of them at this point, sometimes in their home. So I think it is possible. We have to be cautious, but I think it is possible in this model to get people to innovate and actually improve care and lower the cost of care, and I'm not sure of other ways to do that.
Well, and it is one of the reasons that people will not only be rated based on their price, but on their quality. So that if people are underserving, it will show up because their quality isn't going to be as good. If they're not getting that diabetic patient in to get tested frequently enough, if they're not, you know, doing the things they need to do with their patients that have high blood pressure, they're just talking to them on the phone, they're obviously not going to get the outcomes that they need to be able to show to be competitive in that area as well. Other questions? Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is more of a comment, and thank you, Mr. Forsyth, for bringing up the Elwood-Nixon conversation, because I think people can tap into that now on the Internet if you want to see that conversation. It's been released. Presidential tapes have been released. But there, Dr. Elwood is explaining to the president about creating this HMO system, which is actually, you know, the third-party payer medical middleman. And President Nixon is a little confused about that. And Dr. Elwood says, well, it's going to push healthcare dollars into the private sector. It's good for private business. And I think the president responds something like, well, that sounds good to me. So actually, I appreciate you bringing up that conversation.
Other questions? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to take the opportunity to thank these two gentlemen, Mr. Forsyth and Dr. Charlie Fazio, for coming out of their busy schedule and for serving on the task force. And I could sit here and listen to you two till the cows go home, but you explain it very, very well. And this is truly a commitment on their part, and I hope to see you again soon. So we need your help and your expertise, and thank you.
I think there's one thing that we missed that I feel like I need to just comment on, and that is in regard to the question that Senator Olson asked about, you know, her clinic, and, you know, they're the only place to go in their town. And I see the system as giving those clinics more information about the specialists that they work with, in both in terms of price and quality. And so all the specialists that your clinic works with today may not be equal. They probably aren't equal. And so then your clinic will be looking to say, well, gee, you know, we should be sending more of our patients to this cardiologist when we need a specialist. Whereas today, they just sort of go by the best they can, but they don't really have very much information. And so when they are then referring people to higher quality, lower cost specialists who have the patient return back to the clinic with a partnership in terms of the kinds of things that have been done, the kinds of things that the clinic needs to pick up on when they come back, that will give the clinic many more tools and will help the care that's provided to people in that area be much more efficient. Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I can follow what you're saying, you know, and understand why that might be valuable. The problem I have is that there aren't enough details right now publicly, and I know that there are concerns on the part of some of the hospitals that the very specific criteria that will determine who gets these different levels of payment may be geared to provide more dollars because it'll be easier for some to meet those criteria than others, and that it's actually going to potentially lower the share of medical dollars that they're receiving if they're not able to meet those standards. And so it's hard to judge right now because they haven't had a chance. No one's really seen, I don't think, exactly this what are going to be the very specific things that are going to be required to meet those criteria, and then to evaluate how they, you know, what the opportunities are or how that's going to play out as far as whether they can, even though they may want to, you know, do they have the ability to and the access to different things to be able to, what does it mean to be high value? You know what I'm saying?
Well, we know pretty much today what we look at in terms of measuring quality through the Community Measurement Project and through Stratus and Bridges to Excellence. So it isn't like this is a big black box where nobody knows what we're talking about when we talk about different things related to quality. What we don't know is what price is, because every provider has 500 prices, you know. So we couldn't, you know, tell you that today. But the hospital overall knows what their revenue stream is. They know how much money goes through their facility each and every year from all their payers, so they could pretty much be able to figure out what their average price is, if that's kind of what you would want to call it. We don't know, but they know that information.
So, Madam Chair, does that mean that we could see right now, based on those criteria, which hospitals are going to be in which tiers in terms of the level of payment they'll be receiving?
No, because we don't have everyone's average price. The hospital each has one, but this hospital doesn't know what that hospital's average price is, and we don't know all the hospital's average price. And that's why we're going to be phasing this in. I mean, it's going to take a little bit of time for all of that to shake out, and we will start by having people disclose that information. So before they go to level three, everybody would have all of that information. Mr. Forsyth?
Madam Chair, if I could just add something. You have now tripped onto the subject that I feel the most enthusiastic about at all, which I haven't mentioned yet, which is baskets of care. And you know, and Senator Rosen know, that this is where I really get excited about this. So imagine your clinic was primary care providers. You know, so they're internists, they're family practitioners, but they don't do heart surgery. So they're sending someone on a referral to a heart surgeon. They have put forward a total cost of care bid, and now they're recommending to someone that they have surgery. They could actually go to the market, look at the basket of care price from heart surgeons, which would include the hospital component, and they could say, based on the price and the quality, because they could see both, I think here are some recommendations for you as to where you should go. And the fact that this basket of care price would exist from the heart surgeon, including the hospital component, now we have a basis beyond the fact that we went to med school together and that people say nice things about you. Now we have a basis to make that referral in a way that would be based on price and quality. And you have an advocate who has some reason to be involved helping you make that decision that, frankly, you have a hard time making now because you can't see the price and you can't see the quality. So I think the baskets of care in this sort of a model can actually work really well together, and some things should be consumed as baskets. So if you're having a baby, what you really want to do is have a baby. You don't want to see the 47 CPT codes that go into that. We don't want you to have to shop for that, really. We want you to know, what does maternity normal delivery cost? What does it include? And what are the quality measures? And then you could shop on that basis as well if you chose, because your family practitioner isn't also your OB. So there are some things that baskets could really facilitate, and it is an area where inside of this model, the frontline physician, the family practitioner, the internist becomes your advocate in helping you work through that system and is now armed with better information both on price and quality.
Senator Olson,
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just using that idea of a maternity, an example. 10%. So I'm understanding this. So if I, for example, wanted a doctor that would put me in a private or a double room and do the delivery himself and that kind of thing, then I'm probably going to pay more than someone who will put me in a room with four people and have a nurse practitioner, because that costs less and doesn't change the outcome for the baby. Is that kind of what you're saying?
That would be a choice you could make, because now you could tell. You could also judge, what sort of services do they provide? What is included in my basket, and what is it going to price? So maybe it's a labor coach. Maybe it's a private room. This is now beyond my area of expertise for obvious reasons. But there are different bases upon which to choose in this area, not just price, but quality should be a component for sure. And then it may actually be the range of services provided inside the basket. And you may opt to choose one that costs more money because you value those services. That would be a positive.
Dr. Fazio, and then I think we're going to have to quit. We do have one more presentation, but I know that these gentlemen would be happy to take questions from individuals at the back of the room if you have a question that you're not going to get answered right now. Dr. Fazio?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Olson, clinical services, when we think about the competition and the sort of packages, I think they're easier to think about, again, when you get to places where there are more people offering any given service. So what if there were a package around hip pain that included a hip replacement if you needed it? And there were competition among all the places that did it based on quality and experience and time back to full ambulation and those sorts of things. But what if ultimately, in selling those packages to different care systems, some people ultimately decided we shouldn't do this? we can't compete on this service. There's other things that we do better. And we end up over time in places where there are multiple sources of these services with a system that looks a little different than it does now. Everybody doesn't have to do everything. Everybody ought to do the things they're best at. I think when we talk about packages, it's probably even more applicable to those circumstances than in a community where there were fewer options like that. And that, again, gets to be where it's transformational and the incentives are different. The incentives aren't about revenue and being everything to everybody. They're about being efficient and being good.
Thank you both very much. And they'll be here if you want to go back and catch them to
Thank
get another question answered. The next presentation we have is about the healthcare savings offset mechanism used by the state of Maine. And Dr. Lynn Blewett is going to make that presentation. We're very, very happy to have her here today. And the reason we want to know more about this is because there's a similar mechanism in the recommendations that have been made by the Healthcare Access Commission and in the way in which we would be able to reap some reinvestment out of the savings that we might get in this kind of a system. Welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Thank you very much for inviting me today. We don't have a lot of time, so I'm focusing on the Maine offset payment and just to give you some background information on how that is structured, and then we can ask some questions if it's specific to the Minnesota Transformation Task Force proposal. So Maine was one of the first states that did comprehensive health reform, and you don't hear too much about it, but it was in 2003, the DIRGO health plan with the goal of reaching universal coverage by 2009. They provided a DIRGO choice product, which was a private health insurance product, which was offered to small employers and subsidized by the program with sliding scale subsidies for enrollees at less than 300%, who had incomes less than 300% of the federal poverty level, and affordable premiums for those with greater than 300%. Just recently, they switched products from Anthem to Pilgrim Health, so they're in a bit of a transition at the moment. This is an example of the structure of the Maine health plan. Maine Care is as their Medicaid program. The yellow part is their Maine Care expansion, which is their SCHIP program. And then you can see the DIRGO Health, which is 200 to 300% for small employers. And then that darker blue is subsidized, and the top would not be subsidized but would have more affordable premiums than you could find in the traditional market. The program is financed through a number of different mechanisms. The savings offset payment is recovery of reductions in charity care and voluntary savings targets, and we'll talk specifically about that specific financing mechanisms. But there are also employer and individual contributions to premiums, general fund contributions, and then federal matching premiums, federal matching rates for Medicaid and SCHIP premiums. And they did have some disproportionate share dollars at the beginning, but those are no longer available. So the financing savings offset payment is estimated savings from the reduction in the current spending. And the idea is that the DIRGO health plan had a number of different cost containment mechanisms similar to the Transformation Task Force. And the idea was that they would get reductions in current spending. So this is reductions in bad debt charity care due to fewer uninsured, so you have more covered paying patients. There were voluntary growth caps that should be caps, not gaps, which was approximately 4%. So the hospitals providers were all encouraged to restrain their rate of growth. They weren't required, but they were voluntary caps. There were lower rate of hospital growth through voluntary cost controls. There were limits placed on capital investment. And there were increased Medicaid rates for providers through increased physician and provider fees. This is kind of a diagram that shows how this would work. So you have the main health services costs on the far end. Once DRGO reforms are enacted, there would be a reduction in health care services, which the cost savings would be the yellow component, which would be passed on to third-party payers and insurers, health plans through reductions in premiums. And the idea is that savings that's passed through the system would be shared among the players. So some of that component, and you could think of this, I've been kind of thinking about it in terms of teaching your kids to save. So you have a save bucket, you have a spend bucket, and then you have you give bucket. So it's like a third, a third, a third. So in here, the insurers would contribute approximately a third to the savings offset payment program, which funds the DRGO health plan. They could save a third, which is basically their gains or profits in the market, and a third would go to a reduction in premiums. Now, how the health plans divide up, it's just kind of the construct is there's different mechanisms, but the idea is to get the savings that's in the system not only to benefit the health plans, but to be passed on in terms of funding the DRGO health plan and increasing coverage and access. Of course, the devil is in the details. There's been a lot of debate about how those savings were measured. They have a fairly complicated approach to measuring the savings. They measure the voluntary cost growth individually, they estimate the CON, and they estimate the other savings achieved, and so they have quite a complicated approach, which has been under a lot of scrutiny, including federal court challenges. They hired an actuarial firm, Mercer, to do the calculations, and then the board of Maine DRGO makes the adjustment. So this is just an example. In year two, Mercer estimated a total savings in the system of about $140 million, and then the board approved about a third of that would go to the savings offset program. So the assessment on the plan is not for the total savings amount, it's just for a component. One of the court challenges was whether this was an illegal tax on third-party administrators and the health plans. And this particular jurisdiction, Justice Cole's decision in 2006, said that the savings offset payment is not a tax. It's not going to general fund administration. It's going to a specific administration of a specific program, and that's under the jurisdiction of the police power of the states. So that was a specific ruling. Just to highlight, in year one, the saving offset payment was $44 million. In year two, it was $34 million. And this year three, it's $45 million. Again, this applies to claims for third-party administrators and health plans. It's limited to 2.4% of their premium, so there is a cap on how much they will contribute. So if there was an estimate that was higher than that, they would have to adjust. The savings would be adjusted downward. As I said, the Maine Association of Health Plans had a court challenge, and primarily it was based on how the assessments were calculated. It was unsuccessful. The way they did it was upheld in the Cumberland Supreme Court and then the Maine Supreme Court. So they upheld the methodology, but it's still quite controversial in this state. This is a unique approach to financing. It hasn't been done before, and so a lot of states are paying attention to how successful. It's been challenged at every step of the way, but it's currently being upheld by the courts. I think the problem that Maine is facing right now is that the program expenses exceed the savings offset payment, so they're looking for other funding sources, including we've gotten calls about the Minnesota Provider Assessment. They just need a broader base of support for the program. Just funding it off the savings offset payment is not, the current way it's assessed is not covering the, at least in year three, the costs of the program. So that's an overview. I'd be happy to take any questions or, Madam Chair, address any specific questions you had.
So we hope maybe in the future they'll be calling us to find out how they can get more savings so they can have more
that's
revenue
right.
through
that's
their
right.
savings offset. Are there questions? I guess one of the questions that I have is whether this court decision that's quoted here from August 7th, 2006, whether that decision goes to the heart of whether this offset recapture mechanism meets the ERISA test, or whether it was about the mechanism for determining what the savings are.
Madam Chair, my understanding that this was specifically about the estimate of the savings, that I didn't see any ERISA challenge in this document or anything we've seen in Maine.
And so why would you think that would be, that there would not be an ERISA challenge? I mean, if there's so much consternation about it, you would think they would challenge it every which way they could.
Madam Chair, I think the tax is not on an employer, and it's not on a
third-party administrator.
It's on an administrator, but there it's the mechanism of administering the programs. It's not the self-insured plan itself.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's part of the reason. That's what I believe.
You believe that it could withstand that kind of a challenge as
well. Madam Chair, I do believe that, yes.
All right. Are there other questions about this savings offset mechanism? If not, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you, members. This was a good meeting. I appreciate your attendance. That the meeting will be adjourned.